Hey guys, before we get rolling here, I just want to thank those of you who have left me a review on iTunes. This helps me keep the podcast free, so please keep them coming. Tell your friends. I also want to thank those guys that have been sending in the questions. This is what this podcast is about. It's about getting you the info that you need to help become a better hunter. Now you can actually go to my website, interviewswiththehuntingmasters.com, and click on the Ask the Pro section. And you can send me your questions there, and you can even suggest a guest. And lastly, before we jump into this episode, I want to shed a little light on one of my sponsors, Sneak Tech Sneak Boots. I've been wearing them now for several years, and they've really upped my stalking game. I'm not a very sneaky person, and I find that extra added stealthiness that they give me has really, really improved my stalk. I believe in them so much that I've decided to give away one pair each month to a lucky subscriber. So if you're a subscriber, once a month, I'm going to be announcing a winner to win a pair of Sneak Tech boots. So go ahead and go check them out at sneaktech.com, and that's SneekTech.com. Let's get to the next episode. Hi, welcome to the Interviews with the Hunting Masters, brought to you by theoutdoorinsiders.com, your number one spot for inside information and quality gear, and the Sneak Tech Sneak Boot. Today, we're talking with a guy that's no stranger to killing fuzzy monster muleys. And it's Patrick Montgomery. How you doing, buddy?
Man, I'm doing really well. How about yourself?
I'm good. Good.
Good.
Can't complain. I just got back like a week ago from Utah, and getting ready to head to Vegas real quick for a quick trip. And then I come back from that, and I'm going back to Utah for an elk hunt. So it's gonna be a kind of crazy next 7 to 10 days for me here. Just kind of getting a bunch of stuff stuffed in, you know, getting stuff done here before I leave.
Absolutely.
This seems to be the story of my life.
How'd that first hunt go?
You know, I end up shooting a buck. I shot an older, like a big 3x3.
Nice.
And I say big because he had these giant G2s.
Okay.
But he was kind of crabby in the front. I mean, somebody would probably call him a giant forky.
That's all right. Those are my kind of bucks. I like old, mature, heavy deer. They don't always have to score real well.
He was running with five other bucks, and one of my target buck was like a 170 in it, 170-ish, clean 4x4. And I was putting a stalk on him, and I had my headset on. My friends were talking me in on the headphones, and you know, I was working my way down to him, and I came to this like, they really couldn't tell because they were spotting from almost 3 miles away. So it was the aspect of the mountain was kind of like this little, like, it was like a little ledge, like a bench that if sure, I wasn't sure. Right at the edge of it, I couldn't see down further than 15 yards.
Yeah,
but once
I got
to that, I could see about 95 yards. So, and they were kind of on that, and I scooted my way down to it, and I had my cameraman in tow with me, and he was about 50 yards behind me. And he was easing his way down. And I had this 3x in sight already. He was the only one of the bucks that I could see at the mm-hmm. moment. And, so he's just feeding. I could just see the top of his back because what he was in right there, the bushes were kind of tall, and every once in a while he lifts his head up and I could see his horns, and I knew it was the three. We called him bases loaded because he had heavy bases.
Sure.
And the big buck was just behind him, like 5 yards, but I couldn't see him because the mountain had a little curve to it too, so I couldn't quite see around it. And so my camera guy's still inching down, trying to catch up to me, and he breaks a branch, and that buck, that 3-point, looks up at me, and I'm like, oh shit, you know.
Yeah, it's game over.
I still had 3 days left, and I was like, you know what, This like ran through my mind in a matter of like seconds. I'm like, I got 3 days left, but it'd be nice to go home early, you know, make my wife happy.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, no, I'll hold out. But in my head, and because they're talking to me in the headphone, they're like, oh, the other buck didn't lift his head up. He's still feeding and walking. He's going to be there in any second. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, screw it. I drew back. Mm-hmm. I drew back. And now that buck is locked on me because now he saw movement. I mean, I was still pretty good concealed because the grass I was in was real tall and it was just like, you know, he couldn't make out an actual, you know, person there. And I drew back and I held for, I looked back on the video. It was 1:03. I held and that other buck never showed up and he never stepped out. And I was like, you know what? Now I'm starting to get a little shaky. I'm like, well, now I'm going to run the risk of making a bad shot.
Yeah.
So like, screw it. Bird in the hand. I let him have it 65 yards. He ran 40 yards, piled up and tumbled down the mountain 150 yards.
Oh man. Yeah.
So it was a pretty brutal. I only had it like the pack out was like 1.5 miles, 2 miles. It wasn't like super long, but it took me 4 hours.
Oh yeah. No, I can
that's
believe
how it. Shitty steep it was.
Oh yeah. That's where those big deer like to live.
Yeah. Yeah. So but it was cool. I mean, it was a good hunt. I can't complain. I did better my last outing there. So, you know, baby steps.
Yeah. It is what it is. I mean, like I said, each hunt is different and, you know, sometimes you got to take those gifts, you know, when they're given to you.
Oh yeah, for sure. I'm a total bird in the hand guy. I have a lot of friends they can pass a buck that's in front of them 50 yards because there's another buck that's bigger, you know, 20 yards beyond that. And I can't do it. That's not me. I got an itchy trigger finger and I don't have a whole lot of, I'm like guy that like, I'll be a trophy hunter for 2-3 days, but then I'm a tag filler, you know, like I hate to go home empty handed.
Right.
Especially if I'm traveling. I don't mind so much when I'm in Arizona and I know I might have another chance, but I live my seasons like 5 to 7 days at a time. And when I go away and it's like, you know, that's all I got. I'm just going to do what I can. But
yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
So anyway, I do want to talk about that big buck that you shot just recently. But before we get into that, I want to actually ask you a few questions because you've got quite the resume. You've killed a lot of big bucks and I get questions thrown at me all the time about mule deer hunting. So my first question is, what would you suggest to a hunter that only has like 7 to 14 days total in a year? That's like including their scouting and hunting. What would you tell him or her that would help them be more successful?
I mean, I kind of get that question asked a lot myself. And my number one answer is, you know, say you've only got 7 days or 10 days to hunt that year. Mm-hmm. Don't waste 5 days of that going up scouting, you know, a month before the season. Mm-hmm. My philosophy and part of the reason why I am so successful is I'll go up and actually start hunting. Okay, maybe not technically hunting as in carrying my bow, but mm-hmm. I like to go up and start hunting, you know, 4 or 5 days before the season starts. So why there's not a lot of other people up there in the woods, I can get the most up-to-date information about where these big bucks are, where mm-hmm. they're located, what they're doing. And so when it comes opening day, 90% of the time, as it gets daylight, I'm looking into a basin or glassing a burn or something, just looking for the buck that I already know I'm going to kill that day. I'm not hunting. I'm already, you know, I've used my time ahead of the season in the days that are just prior to the opening to find my buck, locate them. And then I'm just trying to get them killed once the season starts.
Makes perfect sense. I think, you know, preseason scouting is great and all, especially if you got a lot of time and just getting yourself acquainted with, you know, terrain and whatnot. And just even using roads or whatever, that's all, you know, whatever time you can save yourself there, but being able to get a more of a, a closer look as to what they're doing right then and there at the time that you're going to be hunting makes more sense. I unfortunately don't get to scout 90% of my hunts because they're always out of state, and I don't have, my wife would kill me if I'm like, hey, I'm going to go for 4 days to Colorado before I go back to Colorado in 2 months. Yeah, she would kill me. So, yeah, it just doesn't work. I mean, I do some cyber scouting. Don't get me wrong. I spend a lot of time on Google Earth and stuff like that. But,
you know, and that's actually, I mean, that's what I'm talking about here. If you've got a week, you can only take a week off, you know, that's all you can afford to be away from work, be away from home, you know, at a time. I would prefer to go and spend 3 days scouting right before the season starts and then hunt for 4 days as opposed to showing up on hunting. Do you see what I'm saying? You know, I'll use those 3 days, you know, to, you know, give myself losing audio.
Just freezing up a little bit here and there. But I get what you're saying. I caught the drift. You'd rather go, if you only had 7 days total, you know, spend the first three of it, scouting or whatever in the area that you're going to hunt, and then spend 4 days hard hunting, as opposed to, you know,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
That makes perfect sense. So I assume because you do that, you do kind of what I do is you look at maps and you look at aerial and stuff like that. What are some of the landscape features? What are some of the things that you look for in a unit that you're hunting, to focus your efforts to? Like, how do you find your starting point?
Well, I mean, for me, you know, almost all my hunting here in Colorado, you know, I've hunted a few places out of state, but in Colorado, I'm either hunting, you know, one of two spots.
For me, in Colorado is where I do most of my hunting, and I'm really looking at two things. I'm either hunting burns, you know, areas that have been burned within the last, you know, 10 years or so, or I'm hunting, you know, up in the high country above timberline, and that just is conducive to the style of hunting that I like to do. You know, I like to get up high, use my optics, you know, use spot and stalk tactics. In order to do that, I need to be able to see where deer are bedding down at in order to be successful. So that's really what I'm looking for, burns or above timberline.
So what I hear you saying is glassable areas, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I guess it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, a burn or a timberline area, but if you've got areas, you know, that it's more open country where you can see deer from a distance, you can watch them with your optics until they go and bed down for the day. That's really what I'm looking for in good stalking opportunities. I will almost never, ever try to stalk deer while they're on their feet moving around.
Right. Right. I think I've actually only killed one buck in its bed, or that was bedded. Most of my bucks, I kill them on their feet. I'm not super sneaky. So I kind of do a spot and ambush.
Gotcha.
Type scenario. And, it's worked for me. It's not ideal. It takes a lot of time. It's a big learning curve to, you know, be able to read where deer's going, or where he wants to get to and get over there. I feel like most of my mule deer specifically, anyway, most of my mule deer that I killed in Arizona, were during the rut. So they don't really bed down very much during that time of year.
Yeah.
So it's always kind of just, Plus, I do utilize, you know, hunting with friends, and we utilize radios when they're legal. So that also adds a big, you know, helping hand if you're not going to be stalking. I don't stalk them. I typically don't go after them if I'm by myself, unless they're bedded. But
right.
Yeah.
And that's generally the way, and that's generally where I'm at. You know, I hunt solo, you know, 99% of the time. So mm-hmm. I don't have the benefit, you know, of being able to have somebody keep an eye on the deer and why they're moving around. And, you know, and for me, that's just, yeah. you know, my style of hunting, and that's what works for me. Not to say that there's 10,000 ways to skin a cat, and you just need to find out a way that you like to do it and what's successful for you and, you know, stick with that method.
Yeah. No, I honestly, by far, that is the smartest way to do it, the way you're doing it. I have a hard time going slow.
right.
I'm not a very patient stalker. I take three steps when I should be taking one. And, so that's why it hasn't been, I haven't killed very many bucks that way. I was exaggerating before when I said that is what I said, but now that I think about it, a lot of my early season bucks were in beds, but it's just, if you can be patient, that's definitely the way to go. If you're an impatient bastard, then that's probably not going to work well for you like me. So.
Well, and you actually, you know, hit on a very important point right there, John, is you need to know your own limitations and what you are good at and, you know, what are downfalls for you. I mean, if you're not a very patient person and you can't, you know, stand to spend 8 hours, you know, stalking a deer, then stalking deer in their beds probably isn't for you. You know, you need to find a different way, you know, to hunt them, or hunt them at a different time of the year when they're up moving around during the rut, when you can, you know, ambush them and do other things. So, I mean, that's just, as far as knowing your strengths, knowing your weaknesses are maybe even more important.
No, for sure. I think, taking a look at yourself and assessing what your tools are definitely a number one in my book for figuring out what you need to do and how you can improve. Even, you know, you can't improve if you don't know what your faults are. So, but no, for sure. Since you are basically a solo hunter and you like to hunt by yourself, you know, you like to hunt by yourself, and can you kind of paint me a picture? You're looking into a basin, you spot a buck, and he's in that spot. What is that spot? Paint that perfect scenario that, you know, if you find a buck in this place with this situation, with this kind of wind, this time of day, you know, he's going to die.
You know, for me, it's all about, you know, getting deer, you know, to bed in some brush or, you know, behind a rock with something that's going to be blocking their view. And then, of course, you know, having the wind blowing from the deer to you. And then I always, if I can approach with the sun at my back, it seems to help me quite a bit. You know, those deer don't usually bed, you know, looking directly into the sun. So, you know, I'm trying to, one, obscure their vision. And then of course, you know, play the wind right. But, a lot of times, you know, deer will bed down, especially in these high basins, they'll bed down in the middle of these thick, you know, willow patches where, I mean, they just go and they lay right down in them where they can't see 3 feet in any direction. And they're just relying totally on being hid and the fact that nobody saw them go in there. So if you can see them do that and you know which patch they're in, you can always take your time and maneuver to get the wind right, you know, or what you need it to be. But when I see deer lay in places like that, yeah, I think to myself, yeah, this deer, he's going to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's not too far off from what I've had success. You know, where I've had the biggest success, and I'll use Wyoming as an example, is when they bed on a bench that's kind of got like a, you know, I don't know, 30, 40 foot cliff above them. Mm-hmm. You know, not something crazy cliff, you know, but when you can crawl out to the edge of a cliff and look straight down and your buck's laying right there.
Oh yeah. They're in trouble then.
Yeah. Those spots like that, especially if the wind's, you know, 100%, but even if it's not 100%, I feel like you could cheat the wind really easy that way because, well, especially if it's during the day, you know, or during the hotter part of the day and the thermals are going up.
Yeah, it's almost like being in a tree stand at that point.
Yeah, yeah. I've had most of my in bed situations play out for me when it was like that. I feel like it's so much easier to get to because you're completely out of sight until you peek your head over that, you know, peek your head over there. And if you can kind of just barely get your eyes over there and don't make a bunch of movement and see where he's at and kind of watch him and wait for that moment where either he puts his head down, completely closes his eyes, or maybe he's already doing that. I mean, you can easily get to draw. Now, it's a much more difficult shot if you're not practicing those type of shots, you know, there's a good chance you're going to whiff it. But that just comes back to your preseason stuff and making sure mm-hmm. that you practice for the game. I love those. And like you were saying before, like they bed down behind a boulder or bed down behind, you know, a big bush or whatever, that's something that obscures their vision of you coming is huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when they're in a willow patch, what do you do? You're just getting to a spot where you know once they get up and walk out of that, you're going to be able to get a shot, or are you trying to go in after them in a willow patch?
You know, each situation is a little bit different. You know, if they're in the middle of a thick patch where I know that even once they stand up, they're not going to be, you know, their body's not going to be very visible, you know, for me to get an arrow in there. Then yeah, I'll try to, usually I'm stalking more to the point of the way that they went into that patch of willows. Cause normally once they stand up, when they come out, they'll come back out of that real thick patch in that same manner. And that's where I want to be set up on. If I think that, you know, maybe the willows are only 2 or 3 feet high and that when they stand up, I can slip an arrow into them. Once I get within shooting distance, you know, I'm not really messing around too much at that point. I will make some noise and get them to stand up on purpose. You know, I'll stand there at full draw where I can shoot over the top of those willows and I'll make some noise to get them to stand up and shoot them as soon as they get out of their bed. I don't like being close to deer for very long. There's too much that can go wrong. The wind can switch, you know, can swirl. So once I get within killing range, I'm trying to get them killed as quickly as possible.
I'm with you on that. See, I've talked to other guys that are tremendous successful hunters. I mean, Travis Nowotny, for instance, he told me he'll just sit there and wait till they come out, you know, stand up and, you know, feed out before he takes a shot. And then another buddy of mine, Marlon Holden, who's a, you know, a avid mule deer hunter. He likes to shoot them while they're laying in their beds. He didn't even wait till them to stand up. It's always great. That's what I love about this podcast. I love to hear all the different, you know, perspectives, so to speak.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned Marlon. I was just talking to him literally 5 minutes before I got onto this call with you.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's a heck of a bow hunter as well. You know, and we both do things, you know, differently. We're both successful. You know, like you said, that's what makes, you know, these podcasts and talking with the other hunters. We all do things differently. It doesn't make anyone better or more successful. It's just doing things differently.
Yeah, no, for sure. But I like that because I feel like, you know, what works in one situation won't always work in another. And the more you know, you know, like, I, for instance, I I try to recall on, you know, other people's experiences. Like sometimes I find myself in a situation and I'm like, well, have I been faced with this situation before? And if I haven't, I start to kind of like, you know, run through my mental Rolodex of, you know, hearing a story from one of my friends or you know, somebody had on the podcast or whatever. And they're like, okay, this is what they did. And then, you know, automatically I have a couple of different options in my head, what I can do.
Oh yeah. And I absolutely think that kind
of, so, well, that's all I got for you as far as questions are concerned. I do want to hear about this latest buck you shot. Did you put a tape on him?
I did. I finally put a tape on him, and just, you know, his green gross score was 187 and a half.
Okay. Okay. Not that that's small, but I when I first saw him, I thought he was probably in the 200 class range. But I mean, that's not far off. 187 is pretty dead. That's a giant buck, man. Hell of a deer, bigger than anything I ever shot.
When you really start scoring these deer and, you know, and picking them apart, I mean, I can tell you exactly, you know, why he didn't. I mean, he's got huge fronts. You know, he's got 13.5-inch G4s, you know, on one side. He's got 18.5-inch G2s. You know, the downfall to this buck as far as, quote, score goes is, you know, he's a narrow buck. So he doesn't, he's only got about a 20-inch inside spread. With narrow bucks, it also usually means your main beams aren't going to grow that long, you know. So if, you know, a 20-inch spread and 20-inch, 21-inch main beams, you lose a lot of inches. And if you look at his threes coming off of his twos, you know, they're about 3 inches, you know, shorter from what they could have been. But, you know, at the end of the day, too, he's also sporting 42 inches of mass and, you know, 13-inch, you know, G4. So, I mean, he's a heck of a deer. I'll shoot him every day, tomorrow, next year, 10 years from now. I'm going to kill deer like that every chance I get.
Absolutely. No, he's an absolute stud. He's a pig of a buck. And really, like I said, he shows really well. Like, he looks even bigger than he is, which is always cooler, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, cool, man. Well, I'd like to hear the story about it. You want to give us a... give us a play-by-play of how it all went down?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, like I said, I actually picked up this tag that I killed this buck in the leftover tag sale. I didn't draw a tag this year, even on my second choice in an area that I normally draw every year, second choice. I didn't draw it. So, actually, I didn't have a tag. Did not have a tag this summer, you know, until that leftover sale in August. And, you know, that's where I ended up picking this tag up. Luckily it was an area, you know, that's not too far from my home here in Denver. And, I was able to go up there and do a little, you know, a little bit of scouting here and there, but, not very much, maybe a day or two. And I just relied on, you know, what's worked for me in the past. You know, I took off, I made sure that I could go up there, you know, starting, 3 days, well, 3.5 days before the season started, and start doing my scouting then. That allowed me to, you know, cover a lot of ground, you know, look into a lot of different basins. You know, I probably in 3 days, I bet I looked at, you know, 65, 70 bucks.
Wow.
It wasn't until the actual opening morning of the season that I hiked up into this new basin. And I found a good buck. You know, I found a buck. He stood up in his bed about 10:30 that morning, and no, he's probably a pretty solid, you know, 180-inch deer. I put a stock on that deer, and, you know, not holding true to my own, you know, method of hunting, you know, I got there and I sat 30 yards from where this buck was buried into this, you know, oak brush, and I sat there for about 4.5-5 hours and hadn't seen any sign of the deer. Deer hadn't stood up. It was starting to get late. You know, it's starting to get towards dark, and, you know, I begin to question myself, was the deer even still there? And got a little bit impatient. You know, I decided I'm going to move in and see where I think this buck is. And, you know, this deer ended up letting me walk up to within, you know, 5 or 6 yards of where he was bedded before he came, you know, busting out of his brush. And, you know, of course, with the bow and arrow, you know, you're not going to draw and shoot. He did finally stop out there at about 42 yards. He was still a little bit farther, you know, still behind some brush there a little bit. And I was hoping I could just arc my arrow over the tops of those willows and it would drop into his vitals. But at, you know, even at 42 yards with these bows today, there's not a whole lot of arc going on there.
No,
and I clipped the tops of those bushes and I missed the deer. And, right. You know, actually, you know, that worked out for me in this instance because the deer hadn't really, didn't know what happened, hadn't smelled me. You know, he could just, you know, heard me, felt my presence, and, you know, so he decided to leave. But I was able to keep an eye on this buck, you know, and kind of follow him along until he drops down into a, you know, a little ravine, you know, where there was a bunch of willows and stuff down there. And he actually led me to the deer that I ended up shooting later. I kind of nicknamed this deer Sexy just because when I first saw him, I was like, oh yeah, that's, you know, that's the kind of deer that I'm looking for. He was better than the one that I just tried to kill. And, you know, I decided at that point, you know, if I could get on that deer, that was going to be the one, you know, that I was going to hunt for the rest of the season. I stayed up there that night. The next day, you know, went back and glassed the basin, and I immediately turned up the first buck that I'd been trying to kill. He went and laid back down almost in the exact same spot as the day before. And, you know, it's funny, just funny how one day's difference, you know, I just, at that point, I didn't really have any interest in killing that deer anymore. I had already targeted this Sexy buck. And so I didn't even try to stalk that other deer. You know, I stayed there in glass for the most of the rest of the day and I couldn't turn up Sexy. So I actually went back home that night. Went back, you know, home to see my wife and daughter. And, I'd been up there, you know, for 5 or 6 days at that point in time, you know, I was getting tired and my calories and energy was getting low. So I came back, you know, stayed for 2 days, waited for the middle of the week when I wouldn't knew there was going to be a whole lot of people and, you know, went back up, you know, spent the night on the mountain. Well, I went up in the dark, I should say that, and set up my camp for the day. And as soon as it got daylight, I was able to find, you know, that Sexy buck and, you know, kind of start playing the cat and mouse game. At first he was with, you know, 4 or 5 other bucks. Then he kind of separated off, which I've kind of found a lot of these older, more mature bucks will do when it comes time to bed. They'll try to find a place where they can lay off by themselves. Just, you know, they don't, I think they know that the more deer that are around and standing up and moving around, you know, it's harder for them to keep tabs on the danger elements going around them. And it also makes them more visible, you know? So this deer went over this little knob. I didn't actually see where he bedded first. So I made a move about a half mile, 3/4 of a mile down this ridge line where I could get an angle, you know, a better angle where I could see, you know, where I was imagining, you know, this deer had gone into bed. And, you know, just set up my tripod, you know, with my binoculars on there. And, you know, I sat there for about 3-4 hours and finally caught Sexy, you know, standing up, you know, to stretch a little bit. And he was all by himself. I watched him for a little bit. He ended up bedding down again in the open. And, I mean, he was pretty smart. There was really only one direction, you know, in that area that people ever come from, and it was up from the ridge that I was on. There's a, you know, a major trail there, people hiking up and down 14,000 foot peaks. You know, that's what they do here in Colorado for fun, I guess. But
yeah,
he had backed up into, you know, some willows where he could watch that ridge line and just keep an eye on it. You know, it didn't bother him, people walking up and down it, but he knew if anybody coming off that ridge line, you know, they probably weren't just a hiker anymore, you know, that they're coming into his basin, you know, to try to hunt him or hunt his buddies. And, but when he did that, he also bedded in out in the wide open sunshine. So I knew he probably wasn't going to stay there for very long. So I was just, you know, I was just patient. I said, you know, he's going to get hot in that sun. He's going to get up, you know, make another move. He's going to go find some shade. Once he gets to that shade, you know, that's where he's going to end up spending the day. And it was probably, you know, about an hour later where,
know, that exact same thing happened. You know, he got up, made a move, got underneath a little tree where he could lay in the shade. And, you know, that's the type of situation where I was, you know, what I was looking for. You know, I had the wind blowing up the
right.
valley. Now at this point, the thermals were coming up. So I had the wind in my face. I knew I could get in an angle to where I could use that brush to block his vision, you know, and continue my stalk from there. The hard part was getting off the top of that ridge, you know, and getting down. It was, you know, it's above timberline where I was at, you know, just shale rock. You know, I had a herd of about 30 mountain goats, you know, feeding around, you know, within 100 yards of me. You know, and he was, you know, still, you know, watching up that ridge line. I needed to make it at about 300 yards off that ridge line in the wide open view of him in order to get down, you know, behind a little hill where I had, you know, some little terrain to work with that would drop mm-hmm. me basically down into the bottom of the valley where he was at. You know, so I just made my move, you know, real slow. You know, I left my pack and everything up there on the top, put my bow in my lap, and, you know, I would just scoot myself down, you know, a foot at a time. I'd go about 5 feet, 10 feet, you know, glass him, make sure, you know, just trying to look at his body language, see if he was paying attention to me or not. And, you know, I did this. It probably took me, you know, close to an hour, you know, to cover, you know, the 250 or 300 yards down the side of that mountain that I needed to get. Maybe even longer than that. I don't really know. But once I was out, I was able to get down, you know, and get out of his sight, you know, I kind of climbed up back on the ridge where I could keep an eye on him. It's another thing that I try to do when I'm stalking these deer that are bedded. I've just come to find that they're going to stand up every 2.5 hours, every 3 hours, generally speaking, you know, to stretch, you know, maybe grab a couple things to eat.
Right.
Then they're usually going to go back to, you know, that usually the second bed of the day that's one in the shade. They'll usually go right back into there. But if I've been stalking for 2 hours and I think that deer's been bedded for 2 to 2.5 hours, you know, I'll stop my stalk, you know, make sure that I can get eyes on him, and just watch him so that when he does get up, if he rebeds someplace else, you know, I see that move. You know, like I said, I'm hunting by myself. I can't rely on somebody else saying, hey, he just got up and he walked around the corner 40 yards.
Right.
And, you know, he's not there by that boulder anymore. I need to be watching for that to happen. And,
exactly.
And he did. He got up. He stood up and he moved and went back, you know, fed for a little bit and then went back to his same original spot. And at that point, I knew I had, you know, another 2.5 hours or so, you know, probably before he was going to get up and make a move or start feeding for the evening. You know, and it just worked out. You know, like I said, we were talking about earlier, I don't usually move on deer while they're up moving around. Once I finally made it to the bottom of the basin, you know, I had, you know, some 4 or 5 foot, you know, willows and stuff in there with pretty good cover. About the time I made it to there, Sexy actually stood up out of his bed and started feeding down the hillside, you know, working towards okay. those willows. That willow patch that I was in was probably, you know, 150 yards, you know, across. And, man, so while he was moving down towards it, I just, you know, started crawling through all that stuff. You know, there's little tunnels and mazes and, you know, keeping an eye on him whenever I could. And I just, you know, I crawled through it. I got to the other edge of it. At one point in time there, I had him feeding, you know, about 60, 70 yards from me. And then wow. he kind of came in and then found a new patch in the bottom, you know, there where he was going to bed up again for another couple hours. And, you know, by that time I was within, you know, 100 yards of him. So when he bedded again, he also, you know, he put himself in a position, you know, he was still watching that ridge line, you know, backed up to it, but I was now down on his level and was able to use that brush and stuff to get to, you know, I ended up getting to within 37 yards of him while he was bedded and he was facing, you know, directly at me. You know, and again, by this point, you know, I had the sun at my back, which I really, you know, think helped me, you know, get set up, you know, and get my bow and everything in position, you know, where I was just sitting on my knees. And I was, you know, at this point, I was just going to lay him out, you know, because I could see him exactly. I knew exactly when he would start to stand up. He wasn't going to catch me off guard. and I still had the wind blowing at my face. So I was just going to wait them out. And, you know, it finally started, the sun started going down behind me and those thermals died down. He was below me in this valley, and I was getting pretty worried that the wind was going to switch and start blowing back down that hill. There was a couple points in there, times where I thought, man, I just need to draw and, you know, either shoot him in his bed or, you know, when he sees me draw, he'll stand up, you know, and I can kill him then. The problem was, again, just those willows, all I could really see was the top third of his body.
Okay.
And, you know, and I just didn't feel real confident in shooting through the tops of those willows. I mean, they're not real thick, but I mean, they are harder than grass, and I could tell that they were, you know, 3 to 4 feet in front of his body. And I was just thinking, man, if I might get more deflection, you know, off of one of those branches than I want, you know, I just need to be patient, you know, wait for him to stand up. Like I said, the wind started dying down, and I was just getting ready to, you know, make a noise, you know, and get him to stand up to where I could shoot him before he blew out of there. And, you know, he stood up on his own, you know, gave a big yawn and a stretch. And by the time he was done stretching, you know, I was already at full draw and, you know, just shot him right there. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, on this particular deer, I didn't make a perfect shot on him. I hit him a little bit low, back behind the heart. Be honest with you, in a non-vital area, I was able to watch him move off about, you know, 75, 80 yards. And he stood there for, you know, half an hour without bedding. It was starting to get, you know, kind of towards dark. I was like, man, I need to get another arrow in this deer.
Right.
If I want to find him, my main purpose being, you know, I need to get him killed now. If I, you know, want to recover the meat, and I don't want the coyotes, you know, to get on him, you know, at the night. So I tried stalking him again. You know, he caught me and he moved off again about another 80 yards, 100 yards. Bedded back down, you know, now he was watching, you know, everything that I did. And I just decided at that point to, you know, just call it back out of there. You know, it's hard to do. I mean, I wanted to put my hands on him more than anything. And I wanted to make sure that the coyotes weren't going to eat him in the nighttime. So, but I left, you know, spent the night on the mountain that night and came back, you know, at daybreak the next day. And, you know, he was dead right there in his bed. And he had been dead for a long time. Probably died, you know, not long after I left him, but, you know, I felt like I made the right choice. If I would have bumped him again, I maybe wouldn't have recovered that deer. So.
Yeah, no, for sure. No, definitely. I mean, obviously you got him, so you made the right choice.
Yeah.
It's always tough when you're in those situations. I found myself a couple times where I screwed that up. I actually did that on a whitetail and, in Florida that I shot a little far back, and I didn't listen to my gut, and I'm like, oh, I know he's laying right over there in that, like, and we were hunting in the swamps, and he was like in this like CRP type, it was actually an old clear cut is what it was.
Okay.
And I was like, I know he's laying right over there, and I'm like, I'm not going to go in after him. And then the guys that I was hunting with are like, oh, well, the coyotes are going to be on them and you're never going to get them. They're going to run them into the swamp. So instead of the coyotes running them into the swamp, we did. And I basically had shot probably what would have been a county record buck, and
oh,
I ended up losing them. Yeah.
Oh,
so yeah, it was pretty, pretty heartbreaking. But hunting out west with deer, I haven't had that happen very much. Like I said, I always hunt with a buddy. So it's always nice to have a guy watching the deer. Even if you made a bad shot, you could kind of see where they go and see where they lay down and kind of, you know, watch what's going on. If they're dying or, you know, it's going to be a long time or it's going to be through the night or whatever. So hunting by yourself, it's a lot more of a guessing game for sure. So you always got to err to the side of caution. Well, cool, man.
Yeah. Like I said, at that point, you know, it's just, I thought I made the right choice, and you always wonder if you do or not, but you know, this time it worked out in my favor. for sure. Well, he's a stud. He's a hell of a buck. Nice to add to the collection. You doing any elk hunting this year? Or?
I do. I've got an over-the-counter tag. I've been, you know, back home taking care of business a little bit, but then usually, you know, for my elk hunts, I try to wait till, especially in the over-the-counter units here in Colorado, I try to wait until after the muzzleloader season is done, because they have muzzleloader running concurrent, you know, at the same time, and especially in these over-the-counter areas, it just puts a lot of people in the woods at the same time, and I've kind of found, again, you know, save my energy, you know, my time. You know, I use kind of that week during muzzleloader season to get caught back up on work and take care of other things around the house that I need to. And then I usually get back up there, you know, the day the muzzleloader season ends and try to hunt the last week, you know, 7-8 days of elk season. And that's what my plan is going to be this year. So we'll see how it goes.
Sweet. Well, awesome, man. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. Where can our listeners find out more about you?
Probably the best way is, you know, they can, you know, find me on Facebook, either my personal, you know, Patrick Montgomery page. I think I'm kind of maxed out on friends there though. So I've also got a P Monty Outdoors, page where they can, you know, go along there and follow along with my photos and adventures and see what I'm up to.
Sweet. Well, good, man. I hope, you have a good rest of the season and, I look forward to hearing back from you after the season. See if you guys if you put anything else down that's another giant.
Yeah, well, like I say, we're going to be hunting elk in an over-the-counter unit, but the areas where I hunt, you know, even there, you know, I've been able to find, you know, some 320, 340 type bulls. So, you know, I'd be pretty happy if I can arrow a bull over 300 in an OTC unit. I'll be super stoked with that.
Oh yeah, for sure. Colorado's tough competition and hard to find. Hard to find really, really good bulls. A lot of bulls, of course, but they're not exactly known for managing for age class over there. So, but unfortunately. Well, good deal, man. Thank you for coming on, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, absolutely. Thanks a lot, John. We'll talk with you later. Good luck with the rest of your season.